The world of whistleblowing is not relegated solely to those individuals who stand up and say something. There are many, many others who should also be considered whistleblowers. They're the attorneys, the journalists, and the activists who work on these same issues, who are out there protecting truth tellers, protecting children, advancing legislation and regulation to encourage and protect truth tellers, and keeping the public informed. Today, we'll talk to one of them about an issue that is as insidious and dangerous as any, domestic violence. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Barry Goldstein is an attorney, an educator, an expert witness, and a prolific author on the issue of domestic violence. He's the co-author of the book Representing the Domestic Violence Survivor, the co-editor of the book Domestic Violence, Abuse, and Child Custody, and the author of the book Scared to Leave, Afraid to Stay. He's been an instructor and supervisor in a New York model batterer program since 1999. He was an attorney representing the victims of domestic violence for 30 years, and he now provides workshops, judicial, and other training regarding domestic violence, particularly related to custody issues. Barry's new book, called The Quincy Solution, Stop Domestic Violence and Save $500 Billion, demonstrates how Americans can dramatically reduce domestic violence crime with proven practices. He has also been the research director for the Stop Abuse campaign. That lasted for years. Barry Goldstein, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to see you, John.
The pleasure's all mine, Barry. And I think the impression that most of us have is that domestic abuse, domestic violence is a serious problem. And correct me if I'm wrong, but we're not just talking about one person beating another person. We're talking about mental, emotional, even sexual abuse as well. Is that correct? And how much of a national problem is this abuse?
That's exactly right. There's an important study from the CDC called the ACE study for adverse childhood experiences. And it demonstrates that most of the harm from domestic violence and child abuse is not the immediate physical injuries. It's living with the fear and stress that abusers cause. Mm. And it is causing enormous harm on a national level. We spend over $1 trillion every year to tolerate men's abuse of women. We are ruining children's lives. We're preventing women and children from reaching their potential. And we're spending billions of dollars on health and crime costs and things of that sort.
I think I've always assumed, Barry, that this was something of a secret or private problem in the United States. Once in a while, somebody famous will be accused of domestic abuse, and then it's in the news for a few days. But it seems that if it was something that we talked about more, that was more out in the open, then it would be easier to address and to perhaps prevent. How do we do that as a society? Is this about legislation? Is it about counseling or therapy? Or is it about media coverage?
Well, I can tell you it's not about counseling or therapy. Domestic violence is not caused by mental illness or substance abuse. And unfortunately, many people still believe that, which causes courts to apply approaches that don't do any good. There has been, you know, thousands of years of societies all over the world encouraging and allowing husbands to abuse and beat their wives, so that, you know, that's a popular belief. Even though the laws have now changed, there are still many, particularly men, who think that this behavior is acceptable.
Right.
The research is clear that only accountability and monitoring are effective in changing abusers' behavior. And unfortunately, courts are reluctant to use the practices that work.
Mm-hmm. Are you detecting a change, or have you detected a change over the years in the way courts address this problem? Are courts more enlightened now, or are we in a position where where we still have a lot of work to do with the courts?
We certainly have a lot of work to do. In the 1970s, domestic violence first became a public issue. Before that, it was a private matter, as you mentioned. And at that time, the popular belief was that domestic violence was caused by mental illness, by substance abuse, and that led courts to turn to mental health professionals as if they were the experts. Mm-hmm. We now know that was a mistake, but the courts keep doing the same things. And what's really happened now is when we first got into domestic violence, society did a number of things that made it easier for victims to leave. It was easier to get divorces, protective orders, shelter, support. And so the domestic violence homicide rate steadily went down. And then the worst abusers figured out that the way to overcome that was to go after custody. Mm. And they've been doing that. And the custody courts failed to recognize these tactics, repeatedly minimize and deny true reports of abuse. And what that means is it's harder for women to leave their abusers. And so the murder rate has gone up and all the other harm from domestic violence is going through the roof.
Tell us a little bit about the laws in the United States relative to domestic violence. And the reason I ask is I'm addicted to this 1970s police show here in the United States called Adam 12. It ran for 7 years between 1969 and 1976. And so many times in this show, the police will go to a home to address an issue of a couple fighting, and invariably the husband has beaten the wife, she has a black eye or a bloody mouth or something, and the police say, "We're sorry, ma'am, there's nothing we can do because you're his wife." They call it wife beating, they did back then, and it wasn't a crime. So what's the situation now in the United States? I'm assuming this is a crime everywhere. Is it a crime that is actually prosecuted? Has that helped?
It's a crime. It does get prosecuted. But if you think about it from the point of view of the victim, you know, she's living with her abuser, and she knows if she reports him, he's going to be angry and he's going to punish her. But if she does nothing, he's going to keep hurting her. So usually at some point, she will report one of his attacks. And the problem is that it's not the first time he ever assaulted her. It's certainly not the first time that he engaged in a variety of less severe tactics. But the courts treat it as if it's his first crime. And so they often use leniency. They don't want him to have a record. You know, they don't want to create real meaningful consequences.
Right.
And so somehow they address the case without any accountability. And what courts do, what police do, and you saw it in the program that you're talking about, mm-hmm. courts look at recidivity, where, you know, they're rearrested, I'm sorry. But what happens is the abuser has been telling his wife, "No one's going to believe you. They're not going to do anything to me." So when he's arrested and nothing happens, it confirms that they're not going to help her. So she doesn't report it anymore. But the legal system, they see that he wasn't rearrested. They assume that they've accomplished something.
Right.
And so they don't do anything helpful, and they lose their opportunity to change things. There are communities that have had great success, and that success has been based on more severe consequences for abusers.
Barry, the people most affected by domestic violence must be children. Can a person overcome the damage that's done when raised in an atmosphere of violence? Is society or our local governments equipped to help children as well as adults fleeing violent situations?
You know, John, I'm really glad you asked that question. we have many custody court judges who have said on the transcript, just because a man hurts the mother doesn't mean he would hurt the child.
Oh, boy.
And it's wrong. When you hurt the mother, you are hurting the child, mm-hmm. and fathers who hurt mothers are 40 to 60% more likely to physically or sexually abuse the child. Mm-hmm. But we have a number of cases where a judge said exactly that, sent the child to have unprotected visitation with the father, and the father killed the child. And even in the face of those tragedies, the courts put it off as, well, that's an exception, and they don't, it doesn't spark the reforms that are needed. Now, just to go a little bit more into your question, again, the ACE study is the leading study. We could use that to change society in the most wonderful ways. So for my Quincy book, I asked medical doctors working with the ACE study, is there something we can do now to save children who have been exposed to multiple ACEs, and that's adverse childhood experiences? The good news is we can save these children. These children could still have full lives, healthy lives, successful lives. But it requires the opposite approach to what child custody courts are doing. And that's what makes it so frustrating.
Barry, one of the concerns that we hear from victims of domestic abuse is that the police and the courts often don't believe them. They're fearful about the divorce process. They're fearful about the child custody process. Victims don't trust the protections that are supposed to be afforded to them by protective orders, for example, or no contact orders, saying, you know, a piece of paper isn't going to protect someone from an angry spouse who happens to have a gun, for example. In your experience, are these fears legitimate? And if so, what else can be done to protect them?
The other major study in the field is the Saunders study, which sought to review the domestic violence knowledge of judges, lawyers, and evaluators. And what they found is that court professionals who do not have the specific domestic violence training that they need tend instead to focus on the myth that mothers frequently make false reports and unscientific alienation theories. And these mistakes lead to recommendations and decisions that harm children. So the studies demonstrate that mothers involved in contested custody cases make deliberate false reports less than 2% of the time.
Wow.
But there is that widespread myth that mothers do that. The same study found that fathers involved in contested custody are 16 times more likely to make deliberate false reports. And that may be confusing because we're not saying mothers are 16 times more honest than fathers. What these studies had to do with contested custody cases, which are overwhelmingly domestic violence cases in which the worst abusers go after custody as a way to regain control and to punish the mother for leaving. It's those abusers who are 16 times more likely to make deliberate false reports, and yet the court professionals have extreme skepticism against the mother's reports and are very happy to believe everything the abusers are telling them. And that's part of the reason that the courts are getting it wrong so often.
We are speaking with attorney, speaker, author, and advocate for victims of domestic abuse, Barry Goldstein. Barry, stay right there with us. We are going to take a short break, but you too stay with us. We have some very specific questions coming up. We'll be right back.
Здравствуйте, меня зовут Эдик. Когда я вырасту, Буду разведчиком.
Тут от него приходит сообщение. Мама, со мной все в порядке, это Эдик. С чужого телефона вышел. У меня уже подозрение, думаю, что это не то. Как-то наивно поверила, что он действительно в глубоком тылу. Хотя как бы вот еще дребезжание внутри было, что, блин, что-то не так.
Взрывы я первый услышал, когда как раз его задело. Потом только я уже увидел, что кто-то упал.
Что мы здесь?
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Barry Goldstein about his experiences advocating for victims of domestic abuse. Barry, thanks again for joining us. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Barry, one of the ongoing themes in divorces where there has been physical abuse is that the victim of the abuse often stops cooperating with authorities once the perpetrator of that abuse seeks custody of the children. You alluded to this a moment ago. Why does that happen? What's the fear there?
Well, you know, I first heard about this when I was doing research about the original Quincy model. This was a group of best practices that resulted in a dramatic reduction in domestic violence crime and especially murder, a county that had averaged 5 to 6 DV homicides, had several years in a row with no murders. And the district attorney there was Bill Delahunt, and he was really the leader of the Quincy model. And he told me that some of the victims in his cases that where they were prosecuting stopped cooperating when men sought custody. And the problem is that when a woman is seeking protection, is seeking to, you know, have their abuser convicted for his crimes, they treat that as, you know, harming the child, as if protecting the child is a bad thing. And so what that does is it hurts her custody case, and that's why victims would stop cooperating. And in the Quincy model, it didn't stop Quincy from being really successful, because at that time it was a rare tactic. Today it has become a standard abuser tactic for abusive fathers to seek custody as a way to regain control over their victim and punish her for leaving. Mm-hmm. And the court professionals don't even think about that. They're not thinking about his motives. They just think that he is acting out of love for the child. And so they keep getting these cases wrong. Mm-hmm. And it makes it harder for victims to leave. And it takes away the last chance for children to have a full and healthy life.
Right. What's the record of the courts in situations like this? Do abusers actually win custody of their children? Do they get visitation with their children? Are some states better than others? Or are the differences between individual judges that it's just impossible to tell how it's going to play out?
Unfortunately, we can tell. I mean, there are some good judges, but unfortunately, they're an exception. There's a recent study called the Myers Study, which was an outcome study. And what we're finding is that the courts are severely tilted in favor of abusers. You know, when a mother raises concerns about possible child sexual abuse, and the father counters by claiming alienation, courts disbelieve 98% of the cases, even though, as we said before, mothers make deliberate false reports less than 2% of the time.
Right.
Which means that a large majority of those cases, the courts are getting wrong. And they're getting it wrong because, if you think about it, domestic violence is about control, including financial control. So most of the money is on the side of abusers, and the courts are not using their powers to level the playing field. They're not using Ace and Saunders, which would help the courts understand the cases. There's gender bias, and we have difficulty talking about it because if you tell a court professional you're engaging in gender bias, they get defensive, they get retaliatory.
Oh,
so
sure.
We're not making progress.
Sure.
And, you know, everything is working in favor of abusers, mm-hmm. and the court system doesn't seem to have a process to take a fresh look at the situation based on the research and come up with better, you know, arrangements. There are actually three government-sponsored studies that have found that evaluations in DV custody cases are working poorly for abused mothers and their children, and yet they still use these practices, and they're getting a high percentage of these cases wrong. To answer your question, there is no good state, and frankly, there's no good country. You know, there are some that may be a little better or a little worse, but across the board, we are failing our children.
I'm interested to hear about your most recent book, too. It's very provocatively titled, The Quincy Solution, Stop Domestic Violence and Save $500 Billion. So can you explain to us how a state, how a nation can save that kind of money where it comes to something like domestic violence?
Okay, so the first thing is we know how to prevent domestic violence because places like Quincy and San Diego and Nashville and other communities have used a group of best practices and dramatically reduced domestic violence crime, particularly homicide. And what they do is they take domestic violence seriously, the crimes, the orders of protection, the probation rules. They use a group of practices to make it easier for victims to leave. They use a coordinated community response. And fundamentally, they take domestic violence seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that when I started my research. But then I was shown an important study from the Academy on Violence and Abuse that found that in the United States, and this was a decade ago, we spend $750 billion a year on health costs related to domestic violence.
I see. Right. Right.
We also spend about $200 billion on crime costs. And if you think about all the women and children who never reach their economic potential, at that time, over a decade ago, we were spending over $1 trillion to allow men to abuse women. I'm sure the number is much higher. The $500 billion recognized we weren't going to end all domestic violence, but we could reduce so much of it if we just used best practices that were effective in the real world.
Yeah.
But we're not doing that. That's what's frustrating.
What can you tell us, and you touched on this a moment ago, what can you tell us about some of these issues in other countries? The reason I ask is that here in the United States, we like to think that we're the best and the brightest, that our way of doing things is always the best way, and for those of us who have lived in other countries around the world, we realize that that's not always true. What countries are doing this right, if any? You said just a moment ago that there probably aren't any.
Well, I mean, what we're fundamentally talking about is the mistreatment of women. When I was in college, we had a button that some people wore, and it had the number 59 on it. That represented how much a woman earned for every dollar a man earned.
Right.
We are making progress. In the United States, the last I saw, the number would probably be about 77%. It's interesting, I'm getting ready to take a cruise next year, and we're gonna go to Iceland. And I recently learned that Iceland is the best country in terms of the treatment of women.
Mm-hmm.
I think the number that we were just talking about is about 85, and they tend to do a lot better than any other case, any other country, they've been voted the best country for women's issues mm-hmm. for many years. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is a couple weeks ago, the women in Iceland went on strike
right.
because they're trying to be treated equally. So even the best country still has a ways to go. In the United States, you know, there's this gender bias. There are, you know, political people that mm-hmm. want to keep women down.
Yeah,
you
sure.
know, they think that men are entitled to superior privileges. And, you know, that's a hard thing to overcome.
Indeed.
And yet we are poorer, we are less healthy, we have, just an inferior lifestyle because we're limiting women and we're not gaining all the advantages we would have from what they can contribute to our society.
Well, Barry Goldstein, thank you so much for those insights and thanks for being with us. Congratulations on the important work you're doing. And thank you to our viewers for joining us. Remember, literally everyone has the human right to live in safety and to live free from violence and abuse. Society has a duty to recognize and to defend this right. Domestic violence is not something that simply takes place behind closed doors and that others can ignore. It's something that affects all of us. It affects all aspects of society. It affects our economy. And most importantly, it affects our children as they're growing up. The only solution is to bring this taboo into the open and to destroy it. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.